Fielding removed the towel that covered the tray. "I recognize the pounds and Deutsche Marks," he said, "but not those two coppery things." "I think they're Belgian francs," I said, "and I got no clue what this cash is." It had been lined up bill by bill to dry. "It looks like it's got some sort of temple on it. And what? What's a dirham? Arabic? I'll get Rose to check." "Why would somebody have four different kinds of money on him?" Fielding asked. "If he was in and out of a lot of countries in a short period of time?" I ventured a guess. "That's all I can think of. Let's get the residues analyzed ASAP." We put on our protective glasses and Vander turned out the lights. The same dull rouge and brilliant orange fluoresced on several of the bills. We scanned all of them on both sides, finding flecks and smudges here and there, and then the ridge detail of a latent fingerprint. It was barely visible on the upper left corner of a 100 dirham bill. "We must be living right," Fielding said. "Hot dog," Vander chortled. "Two for two. I'm going to hop on this right away. Get one of my buddies at Secret Service to run 'em through Morpho, Printrack, NEC, APHIS, WIN, whatever. Every database out there, all 40-50 million prints." Nothing excited Vander more than finding a loop or whirl he could hurl through cyberspace to hog-tie a criminal. "Is the FBI's national database up and running yet?" Fielding asked. "Secret Service already has every damn print the FBI does, but as usual, the Bureau has to recreate the wheel. Spending all this money to create their own database and using different vendors so everything is incompatible with everybody else. I've got a dinner to go to tonight." He focused the Lumalight on the foul, dark flesh pinned to the cutting board, and instantly two specks fluoresced bright yellow. They were not much bigger than a nail head, and were parallel and symmetrical and could not be rubbed off. "I'm pretty sure it's a tattoo," I said. "Yeah," Vander agreed. "Don't know what else it could be. Nothing else is doing anything." The flesh from the dead man's back was murky and muddy in the cool blue light. "But see how dark this is in here?" Vander's gloved finger outlined an area about the size of my hand. "I wonder what the hell that is," Fielding said. "I just don't know why it's so dark," Vander mused. "Maybe the tattoo's black or brown," I suggested. "Well, we'll give Phil a whirl at it," Vander said. "What time's it getting to be? You know, I wish Edith hadn't said we'd do this dinner tonight. I gotta go, Dr. Scarpetta. You're on your own." "Damn, damn! I hate it when Edith wants to celebrate something." "Ah, come on, big guy," Fielding said. "You know what a party animal you are. I don't drink much anymore. I feel it." "You're supposed to feel it, Niels," I said. Phil LaPointe was not in a good mood when I walked into the image enhancement lab, which looked more like a production studio than a place where scientists worked with pixels and contrasts in all shades of light and dark to put a face on evil. LaPointe was one of our first institute graduates, and he was skilled and determined, but had not yet learned to move on when a case absolutely wouldn't. "Damn," he said, raking his fingers through thick red hair, and squinting as he leaned into a 24-inch screen. "I hate to do this to you," I said. He impatiently tapped keys, rolling another shade of gray down a freeze frame from a convenience store videotape. The figure in dark glasses and hairnet cap was not made much clearer, but the store clerk was certainly vivid, as blood sprayed in a fine mist from his head. "I tweak it, and it's almost there, and then it's not," LaPointe wearily complained with a sigh. "I see this damn thing in my sleep." "Unbelievable," I said, staring. "Look how relaxed he is. It's like all of it is an afterthought, no big deal. A what the hell may as well." "Yeah, that much I've got," LaPointe stretched his back. "Just wasted the guy for no reason. That's what I don't get."
"I give you a few more years and you'll get it," I said.
"I don't want to become cynical, if that's what you're saying."
"It's not getting cynical. It's about finally figuring out there don't have to be reasons," I told him.
He stared at the computer screen, lost in the last picture that had ever captured Pyle Gant alive. I had performed his autopsy. "The Let's see what we've got here,
Lapointe said, removing the towel from the surgical pan. Gant was 23, with a 2-month-old baby, and working overtime to pay for his wife's birthday necklace on layaway.
This must be from the container man. You're thinking a tattoo?
Gant lost control of his bladder before he was shot.
Dr. Scarpetta?
I knew this because the back of his jeans and the seat of the chair behind the counter was soaked with urine. When I looked out the window, 2 cops were restraining his hysterical wife in the parking lot.
Dr. Scarpetta?
She was screaming and slapping. She still had braces on her teeth.
$31.12,
I muttered. Lapointe saved the file and closed it.
What was? He asked me.
That's what was in the cash register, I replied.
Lapointe rolled his chair around, opening drawers and getting out different colored filters and rummaging for gloves.
The phone rang and he answered it.
Hold on. He held the receiver out to me. It's for you.
It was Rose. I got hold of someone in the foreign currency department of Crestar, she said. The money you asked me about is Moroccan. To date, there are 9.3 dirham to the dollar, so 2,000 dirham would be about $215.
Thank you, Rose. And there's one other thing you might find interesting, she went on.
It's forbidden for Moroccan money to be brought in or taken out of the country.
I have a feeling this guy was into a lot of things that are forbidden, I said.
Can you try Agent Francisco again?
Certainly.
My understanding of ATF protocols was fast turning into the fear that Lucy had rejected me. I desperately wanted to see her. I wanted to do whatever I had to do to make that happen. I hung up and lifted the cork cutting board out of the pan, and Lapointe looked at it under a strong light.
I'm not feeling real optimistic about this one, he let me know.
Well, don't start seeing this one in your sleep, too, I told him.
I'm not hopeful either. All we can do is try.
What was left of the epidermis was as greenish-black as a quarry or a swamp, and the flesh underneath was getting darker and drier like curing meat. We centered the cork board under a high-resolution camera that was connected to the video screen.
Nope, Lapointe said. Too much reflection.
He tried oblique light and then switched to black and white. He fitted various filters over the camera lens. Blue was no good, nor was yellow, but when he tried red, the iridescent specks peeked out at us again. Lapointe enlarged them. They were perfectly round. I thought of full moons, of a werewolf with evil yellow eyes.
I'm not going to be able to get this any better live. I'll just grab it, Lapointe said, disappointed.
He captured the image onto his hard drive and began to process it, the software making it possible for us to see some 200 shades of gray that we couldn't detect with the unaided eye. Lapointe worked the keyboard and mouse, going in and out of windows, and using contrast, brightness, and enlarging, shrinking and adjusting. He eliminated background noise, or trash, as he called it, and we began to see hair pores, and then the stippling made by a tattoo needle. Out of the murk emerged black wavy lines that became fur or feathers. A black line sprouting daisy petals became a claw.
What do you think? I asked Lapointe.
I think this is the best we're going to get, he impatiently said.
We know anybody who's an expert in tattoos?
Why don't you start with your histologist, he said.
21.
I found George Guerra in his lab, retrieving his bagged lunch from a refrigerator posted with a sign that read, No Food. Inside were stains such as silver nitrate and mucic carmine, in addition to Schiff reagents, none of which was compatible with anything edible.
That's not such a great idea, I said.
I'm sorry, he stuttered, setting the bag on the counter and shutting the refrigerator door.
We have a fridge in the break room, George, I said. You're more than welcome to use it.
He didn't respond, and I realized that he was so painfully shy he probably didn't go into the break room for a reason. My heart ached for him. I couldn't imagine the shame he must have felt when he was growing up and couldn't talk without stuttering. Maybe that explained the tattoos slowly taking over his body like kudzu. Maybe they made him feel special and manly. I pulled out a chair and sat down. "George, can I ask you about your tattoos?" I asked. He blushed. "I'm fascinated by them and need some help with a problem."
"Sure," he said with uncertainty.
"Do you have someone you go to? A real expert? Someone very experienced in tattooing?"
"Yes, ma'am," he replied. "I wouldn't go to just anyone."
"You get your tattoos locally? Because I need to find a place where I can ask some questions and not run into bad characters, if you know what I mean."
"Pit," he immediately said. "As in Pitbull, but Pitt's his real name. John Pitt. He's a really good guy. You want me to call him for you?" he asked, stuttering badly.
"I would be grateful if you would," I said. Gara pulled a small address book out of his back pocket and looked up a number. When he got Pitt on the line, he explained who I was, and apparently Pitt was very agreeable.
"Here," Gara handed me the phone. "I'll let you explain the rest of it."
That took several efforts. Pitt was home and just waking up.
"So you think you might have some luck?" I asked. "I've seen pretty much all the Flash out there," he replied.
"I'm sorry, I don't know what that is."
"Flash is the stencils, I guess you could call them. You know, the design people pick out. Every inch of wall space I got is covered with Flash. That's why I'm thinking you might want to come here instead of me coming to your office. We might see something that gives us a clue. But I will tell you, I'm not open Wednesdays or Thursdays. And payday weekend just about killed me. I'm still recovering. But I'll open up for you, since this must be important. You bringing in whoever's got this tattoo?"
He still didn't quite get it. "No, I'm bringing the tattoo," I said. "But not the person who goes with it."
"Wait a minute," he said. Okay, now I'm hearing you. So you cut it off the dead guy."
"Can you handle that?"
"Oh, hell yeah, I can handle anything."
"What time?"
"How about as soon as you can get here?"
I hung up and was startled to see Ruffin in the doorway watching me. I had a feeling he'd been there for a while, listening to my conversation, since my back was to him as I'd taken notes. His face was tired, his eyes red, as if he'd been up half the night drinking. "You don't look well, Chuck," I said, without much sympathy.
"I was wondering if I could go home," he said. "I think I'm coming down with something."
"I'm so sorry to hear that. There's a new, very contagious strain going around, thought to be carried by the Internet. It's called the 630 bug," I said. "People dash home from work and log on to their home computers. If they have a home computer."
Ruffin's face turned white.
"That's pretty funny," Gara said. "But I don't get the 630 part of it."
"The time half the world signs on to AOL," I replied.
"Of course, Chuck, you can go home. Get some rest. I'll walk you out. We need to stop in the decomposed room first and get the tattoo."
I had removed it from the corkboard and placed it inside a jar of formalin. "They say it is going to be a really weird winter," Ruffin began to prattle. "I was listening to the radio this morning while I was driving into work, and it's like it's going to get real cold closer to Christmas and then be like spring again in February."
I opened the automatic doors to the decomposed room and walked in as trace evidence examiner Larry Posner and an institute student worked on the dead man's clothes.
"I'm always happy to see you guys," I greeted them.
"Well, I've got to admit, you've given us another one of your challenges," said Posner, as he used a scalpel to scrape dirt off a shoe onto a sheet of white paper. "You know Carlyle?"
"Is he teaching you anything?" I asked the young man.
"Sometimes," he replied.
"How you doing, Chuck?" Posner said. "You don't look so good."
"Hanging in there," Chuck kept up his sick routine.
"Sorry about the Richmond PD," he said with a sympathetic smile.
Ruffin was visibly shaken.
"Excuse me?" he said.
Posner looked uncomfortable as he replied,
"I heard the Academy didn't work out. You know, I just wanted to tell you not to be discouraged."
Ruffin's eyes cut to the phone.
"Most people don't know this,"
Posner went on as he started work on another shoe. I flunked the first two tests in Chemistry 101 at VCU.
No kidding, Ruffin muttered.
Now you tell me, Carlyle feigned horror and disgust. And here I was told I'd get the best instructors in the world if I came here. I want my money back.
Got something to show you, Dr. Scarpetta, Posner said, pushing back his face shield.
He set down the scalpel and folded the sheet of paper with a jeweler's fold and moved over to the pair of black jeans Carlyle was working on. They were carefully laid out on the sheet-covered gurney. The waistband had been turned inside out to the hips, and Carlyle was gently collecting hairs with needle-nosed forceps.
"This is the damnedest thing," Posner said, pointing a gloved finger without touching while his trainee carefully folded the jeans down another inch, revealing more hairs.
"We've already collected dozens," Posner was telling me. "You know, we began folding down the jeans and found the expected pubic hair in the crotch, but then there's this blonde stuff, and each inch we go, there's more of it. It doesn't make sense."
"It doesn't seem to," I agreed.
"Maybe some sort of animal, like a Persian cat?" Carlyle suggested.
Ruffin opened a cupboard and took out the plastic bottle of formalin that contained the tattoo.
"If it was sleeping on top of the jeans while they were inside out, for example?" Carlyle went on.
"You know, a lot of times when my jeans are a pain to get off, they end up inside out and tossed on a chair, and my dog loves to sleep on top of my clothes."
"I don't guess hanging things up or putting them in drawers ever occurs to you,"
Posner remarked.
"Is that part of my homework?"
"I'll go find a bag to put this in," Ruffin said, holding up the jar.
"In case it leaks or something."
"Good idea," I said. Then I asked Posner, "How quickly can you take a look at all this?"
"For you, I'll ask the lethal question," he said. "How quickly do you need it?"
I sighed.
"Okay, okay.
We've got Interpol trying to track down who this guy is. I feel under as much pressure as everybody else, Larry," I said.
"You don't need to explain. I know when you say jump, there's always a good reason."
"I guess I put my foot in my mouth," he added.
"What's with that kid? He acted like he didn't know he wasn't accepted at the police academy. Hell, it's all over the building."
"First of all, I didn't know he didn't get in," I said. "And second, I don't know why it's all over the building." Even as I said it, Marino came to mind. He said he was going to fix Ruffin, and maybe he just did by somehow finding out the news and gleefully spreading it.
"Supposedly Bray's the one who gave him the boot," Posner went on.
Moments later, Ruffin returned with a plastic bag in hand. We left the decomposed room and washed up in our respective locker rooms. I took my time. I made him wait in the hall, knowing his anxiety was heating up with every second that went by. When I finally emerged, we walked together in silence, and he stopped twice to take a nervous drink of water.
"I hope I'm not getting a fever," he said.
I stopped and looked at him, and he involuntarily jerked away when I placed the back of my hand on his cheek. "I think you're fine," I said. I accompanied him through the lobby and into the parking lot, and by now he was clearly frightened.
"Is something wrong?" he finally asked, clearing his throat and putting on sunglasses.
"Why would you ask me that?" I innocently said.
"You walking me out here and everything."
"I'm heading to my car."
"I'm sorry I said to you what I did about problems here and the internet stuff and everything," he said. "I knew it was better to keep it to myself, that you would get mad at me."
"Why would you think I'm mad at you?" I asked as I unlocked my car. He seemed at a loss for words. I opened the trunk and set the plastic bag inside it.
"You got a nick on the paint there, probably from a kicked-up rock, but it's starting to rust."
"Chuck, I want you to hear what I'm saying," I calmly told him.
"I know."
"What? I don't understand what you mean." He tripped over words.
"You understand completely."
I got into the front seat and turned on the engine.
"Get in, Chuck," I said. "You don't need to stand out in the cold, especially since you're not feeling well."
He hesitated and exuded fear like an odor as he walked around to the passenger's side.
Sorry you weren't able to make it to Buckhead's. We had an interesting conversation with Deputy Chief Bray, I said as he shut his door. His mouth fell open. It's a relief to me to have so many questions answered at last, I went on. Email, the internet, rumors about my career, leaks. I waited to see what he would say to this and was startled when he blurted out, That's why I suddenly didn't make it into the academy, isn't it? You see her last night and this morning I get the news. You badmouthed me, told her not to hire me, then spread it everywhere to embarrass me. Your name never came up once. And I most certainly haven't spread anything about you anywhere. Bullshit! His angry voice trembled as if he might cry. I've wanted to be a cop all my life and now you ruined it. No, Chuck, you ruined it. Call the chief and say something. You can, he begged like a distraught child. Please! Why were you meeting Bray last night? Because she told me to. I don't know what she wanted. She just sent me a page and told me to be in the parking lot at Buckhead's at 5:30. And, of course, in her mind, you never showed up. I expect that may have something to do with why you got bad news this morning. What do you think?
I guess, he mumbled.
How are you feeling? Still sick? If not, I've got to head out to Petersburg, and I think you should ride with me so we can finish this conversation.
Well, well what, Chuck?
I want to finish the conversation, too, he said. Start with how you know Deputy Chief Bray. I find it rather extraordinary that you should have what seems to be a personal relationship with the most powerful person in the police department.
Imagine how I felt when it all started, he innocently said.
See, Detective Anderson called me a couple months ago, said she was new and wanted to ask me questions about the ME's office, about our procedures, and could I meet her at the River City Diner for lunch. That was when I got on the road to hell, and I know I should have said something to you about her call. I should have told you what I was doing. But you were teaching classes most of the day, and I didn't want to bother you, and Dr. Fielding was in court. So I told Anderson I'd be glad to help her out. Well, it's pretty obvious she didn't learn anything. She was setting me up, he said. And when I walked into the River City Diner, I couldn't believe it. She was sitting in a booth with Deputy Chief Bray, and she told me she wanted to know all about the way our office runs, too.
Who did? Bray did.
I see. Big surprise, I said.
I guess I was really flattered but nervous, too, because I didn't understand what was going on. I mean, next thing she's telling me to walk back to police headquarters with her and Anderson.
Why didn't you tell me all this at the time? I said, as we drove toward Fifth Street to pick up I-95 South.
I don't know, his voice trailed off.
I think you do.
I was scared.
Might it have anything to do with your ambition of becoming a police officer?
Well, let's face it, he said. What better connection could I have? And somehow she knew I was interested, and when we got to her office, she closed the door and sat me across from her desk.
Was Anderson there?
Just Bray and me.
She said that with my experience I might think about becoming a crime scene technician. I felt like I'd won the lottery. I was working hard at keeping my distance from cement barriers and aggressive drivers while Ruffin continued his choir boy act.
I have to admit I was in a dream after that and lost interest in my job, and I'm sorry for that, he said. But it wasn't until 2 weeks later that Bray emailed me.
Where did she get your email address?
She asked for it. So she emailed me and said she wanted me to drop by her house at 5:30. That she had something very confidential to discuss with me. And I'm telling you, Dr. Scarpetta, I didn't want to go. I knew something bad was going to come out of it.
Such as?
I halfway wondered if maybe she was going to hit on me or something.
Did she?
What happened when you got to her house? I asked.
Gosh, this is really hard to say.
Say it.
She got me a beer and moved her chair real close to the couch where I was sitting. She asked me all kinds of questions about myself, like she was really interested in me as a person, and a loaded-down logging truck pulled in front of me, and I sped around it.
I hate those things, I said.
Me too, Chuck said, and his shoe-licking tone was making me sick.
And what, you were telling me? I said.
He took a deep breath. He got very interested in the trucks bearing down on us and the men working with mounds of asphalt on the roadside.
It seemed as if this stretch of I-95 near Petersburg had been under construction since the Civil War.
She wasn't in a uniform, if you get what I mean, he resumed with overblown sincerity. She had on a business suit, but I don't think she was wearing a bra, or at least the blouse. You could sort of see through it.
Did she ever try to seduce you? Make any overture at all beyond how she was dressed? I asked.
No, ma'am, but it was like maybe she was hoping I would. And now I know why. She wouldn't go for it, but she'd hold it over me. Just one more way to control me. So when she got me my second beer, she got down to what she wanted. She said it was important I know the truth about you.
Which is?
She said you're unstable.
Everybody knew you'd lost your grip. Those were her exact words. That you were almost bankrupt because you're a compulsive shopper.
Compulsive shopper?
She said something about your house and car.
Why would she know anything about my house? I asked, realizing that Ruffin knew about both, among many other things.
I don't know, he said. I guess the worst thing, though, was what she said about your work. That you'd been screwing up cases and the detectives were beginning to complain, except for Marino. He was covering up for you, which was why she was going to have to do something about him eventually.
And she certainly did, I said, without a trace of emotion.
Gee, do I have to go on? He said. I don't want to say all these things to you.
Chuck, would you like a chance to start over and undo some of the damage you've done?
I set him up.
God, if only I could, he said, as if he really meant it.
Then tell me the truth. Tell me everything. Let's get you back on the right track so you can have a happy life, I encouraged him. I knew the little bastard would turn on anyone if it was in his best interest.
She said one of the reasons she'd been hired was the chief, the mayor, and city council wanted to get rid of you but didn't know how. Ruffin went on as if the words caused him pain.
That they couldn't because you don't work for the city. The governor basically had to do it. She explained to me it's like when a new city manager is hired because people want to get rid of a bad police chief. It was amazing. She was so convincing. I was sucked in. Then, and I'll never forget it, she got up from her chair and sat next to me. She looked into my eyes. She said, Chuck, your boss is going to ruin your life, do you understand? She's going to take down everyone around her, especially you. I asked her, why me? And she said, because you're a nothing to her. People like her may act nice, but deep down they think they're God and have contempt for minions. She asked me if I knew what a minion was, and I said I didn't. She told me it was a servant. Well, that got me mad.
I guess so, I said. I've never treated you or anyone like a servant, Chuck.
I know, I know. I believed some of his account was true. Most of it was self-serving and slanted, I was sure.
So I started doing things for her. Little things at first, he went on. And every time I did one bad thing, it got easier to do the next. It's like I got harder and harder inside and talked myself into believing everything I was doing was justified, even right. Maybe so I could sleep at night. Then the things she wanted got big, like the email. Only she got Anderson to give me those assignments. Bray's too slippery to get caught.
What things, for example? I said.
Dropping the bullet down the sink. That was bad enough.
Yes, it was, I said, holding in my contempt for him.
Which is one of the reasons I knew something really big must be on her mind when she sent me the email about meeting her at Buckhead's last night, he went on. She said not to say a word to anyone and not answer her back unless there was a problem. Just to show up, period.
I was scared to death of her by then, he said, and that part I certainly believed. She had me, you know. I was dirty and she had me. I was so scared of what she might ask me to do next.
And what might that have been?
He hesitated.
A transfer truck swerved in front of me and I tapped my brakes. Bulldozers were moving dirt on the embankment and dust was everywhere.
Screw up the container man case?
I knew that was coming. She was going to get me to tamper with something to get you into so much trouble that it was over for you. And what better case than one with Interpol and everything, with all the interest?
"And have you done something to compromise that case, Chuck?" I said.
"No, ma'am."
"Have you tampered with any case?"
"Other than the bullet, no, ma'am."
"You realize, of course, you would be committing a felony if you altered or destroyed evidence? Do you realize Bray's heading you toward prison and probably even setting you up for it so she can get you out of the way after she's finished with me?"
"Deep down, I don't think she'd do that to me," he said.
He was nothing to her. He was a flunky who didn't have sense enough to avoid a trap when he found one because his ego and ambition got in the way.
"You're sure about that?" I said.
"Sure, Bray wouldn't make you the fall guy."
He wavered.
"Are you the one who's been stealing things in the office?"
I hit the matter head on and asked.
"I have all of it. She wanted me to do anything I could to make you look like you couldn't run the office. It's all at my house in a box. Eventually I was going to leave it in the building somewhere so someone would find it and return the stuff to everyone."
"Why would you let her have this much power over you?" I asked.
"So much that you would lie and steal and premeditate tampering with evidence?"
"Oh, please, don't let me get arrested, go to prison," he said in a panicky voice that would win him no acting awards. "I have a wife, a baby on the way. I'll commit suicide, I promise I will. I know lots of ways to do it."
"Don't even think such a thing," I said. "Don't ever say that again."
"I will. I'm ruined, and it's all my fault, nobody else's."
"You're not ruined unless you choose to be."
"It doesn't matter anymore," he muttered, and I was beginning to fear he might be serious. He was constantly licking his lips, and his words were sticky because his mouth was so dry.
"My wife wouldn't care, and the baby doesn't need to grow up with a father in prison."
"Don't you dare send your body to me," I told him angrily. "Don't you dare have me walk in and find you on one of my tables."
He turned to me, shocked.
"Grow up," I said. "You don't just shoot your brains out when things turn to shit, do you hear me? Do you know what suicide is?"
He stared wide-eyed at me.
"It's getting in the last pissed-off word. It's a big so there," I said.
22. The pit stop was just past Kate's beauty salon and a small house with a sign out front advertising a psychic. I parked next to a beat-up black pickup truck tattooed with multiple bumper stickers that gave me broad hints about Mr. Pitt. The door to his business instantly opened, and I was greeted by a man whose exposed skin, every inch of it, including his neck and head, was tattooed. His body piercing made me cringe. He was older than I had expected, probably in his 50s, a wiry man with a long gray ponytail and a beard. He had a face that looked as if it had been beaten up a few times, and he dressed in a black leather vest over a T-shirt. His wallet was chained to his jeans.
"You must be Pitt," I said as I opened the trunk to get out the plastic bag.
"Come on in," he replied in a relaxed way, as if nothing in the world was off kilter or worth worrying about.
He walked in ahead of Ruffin and me and called out,
"Taxi, sit girl."
Then he assured us,
"Don't worry about her. She's gentler than baby shampoo."
I knew I wasn't going to like what was inside his shop.
"I didn't know you were bringing anybody with you," Pitt commented, and I noticed his tongue sported a pointed silver post. "What's your name?"
"Chuck."
"He's one of my assistants," I explained. "If you have a place to sit, he'll wait." Taxi was a pit bull, a brown and black square block of muscle on four legs.
"Oh, yeah."
Pitt was pointing out a corner of the room where there was a TV and a sitting area.
"We gotta have a place for the customers to wait for their appointments. Chuck, you just help yourself. Let me know if you need change for the Coke machine."
"Thanks," he said, subdued. I didn't like the way Taxi stared at me. I would never trust a pit bull, no matter how gentle its owner said it was. To me, the mixture of bulldog and terrier had created the Frankenstein of breeding, and I had seen my share of torn-up people, especially children.
"Okay, Taxi, tummy rub," Pitt said in a cooing voice.
Taxi rolled over, legs in the air, and her master squatted and began rubbing her stomach.
"You know,
he looked up at Chuck and me.
"These dogs aren't bad unless the owners want them to be. They're just big babies, aren't you, Taxi? I named her Taxi because some taxi driver came in here a year back and wanted a tattoo. Said he'd trade me a pit bull puppy for a grim reaper with his ex-wife's name under it. So that's what I did, didn't I, girl? Kind of a joke that she's a pit and I am too. We ain't related."
Pitt's shop was a world I didn't know and couldn't have imagined, and I'd visited some very strange places in my career. Walls were covered with flash, every example edge to edge. There were thousands of Indians, winged horses, dragons, fish, frogs, and cultist symbols that meant nothing to me. Pitt's trust no one and been there, fucked that opinions were everywhere. Plastic skulls grimaced from shelves and tables, and tattoo magazines were placed about for brave hearts to flip through while they waited for the needle. Oddly, what I would have found so offensive just an hour ago suddenly took on the authority and truth of a creed. People like Pitt and probably much of his clientele were outlaws who bucked anything that took away the right of people to be who and what they are. Out of place in all of this was the dead man whose flesh I was carrying in a jar. There was nothing countercultural or defiant about someone dressed in Armani clothes and crocodile shoes. "How did you get into this?" I asked Pitt. Chuck began browsing sheet flash as if he were wandering through an art museum. I set the bag on the countertop by the cash register.
"Graffiti," Pitt replied. "I bring a lot of that into my style, sort of like grime at Primal Urge out in San Fran. Not that I'm saying I'm anywhere near as good as him. But if you combine bright, more graffiti-like images with the bolder lines of the old school, that's me."
He tapped his finger on a framed photograph of a nude woman smiling slyly, arms provocatively crossed over her breasts. She had a sunset behind a lighthouse on her belly.
"Now that lady there," he said, "she comes in here with her boyfriend and says he's giving her a tattoo for her birthday. She starts out with this little itty-bitty butterfly on her hip, scared to death. After that, she comes back every week for another one."
"Why?" I asked.
"It's addicting."
"Most people get more than one?"
"Most who get just one want to tuck it somewhere, usually out of sight, like a heart on a butt or a boob. In other words, that one tattoo has special meaning. Or maybe the person got it when they were drunk. That happens too, but not in my shop. I won't touch you if you smell like booze."
If someone had one tattoo on his back and nowhere else on his body, as best I can tell, important? Maybe something more than bravado or being drunk? I asked.
"I'd say so. The back's a place people see unless you never take your shirt off. So yeah, I'd say it probably meant something."
He looked at the bag on the countertop.
"So the tattoo in there came from the guy's back," he said.
"Two round yellow dots, each one about the circumference of a nail head." Pitt stood still and pondered this, his face screwed up as if he were in pain.
"They got pupils like eyes would?" he asked.
"No," I said, glancing at Chuck to see if he were in range of our conversation. He was sitting on a couch, flipping through a magazine.
"Gosh," Pitt said, "that's a hard one. No pupils. Can't think of anything without pupils if it's an animal or bird of some kind. Sounds to me you aren't talking flash. More likely it's custom."
He swept both hands over his shop, conducting his own orchestra of outrageous design.
"Now all that's sheets of flash," he said, "as opposed to a tattoo artist's original work like grime. I'm saying you can look at some tattoos and recognize a particular style, no different than Van Gogh or Picasso. For example, I could spot a Jack Ruby or Tintin anywhere. Most beautiful gray work you'll ever see."
Pitt led me across the shop into what looked like a typical examining room in a doctor's office. It was equipped with an autoclave, ultrasonic cleaner, surgical soap, bio-wrap, A&D ointment, tongue depressors, and packs of sterile needles in big glass jars. The actual tattooing machine looked like something an electrologist would use, and there was a cart with squirt bottles of bright paints and caps for mixing. Central to all this was a gynecological chair. I supposed stirrups made it easier to work on legs and other parts of the body I didn't want to think about. Pitt spread a towel on a countertop and we pulled on surgical gloves. He switched on a surgical lamp, pulling it close as I unscrewed the lid from the jar, my nose instantly assaulted by formalin's acrid bite. I dipped into the pink chemical and pulled out the block of skin. It was rubbery, the tissue permanently preserved, and Pitt took it from me without pause and held it up in the light. He turned it this way and that and looked at it through a magnifying glass.
"Oh, yeah," he said. "I see those little suckers. Yep, there's claws holding on a branch. If you kind of lift the image out of the background, you can see the tail feathers."
"A bird?"
"It's a bird, all right," he said. "Maybe an owl. You know, it's the eyes that jump out at you, and I think they were bigger than this at one time. The shading gives it away. Right here."
I leaned closer, his gloved finger moving over the skin in brush strokes.
"See it?"
"No,
it's very faint. Eyes have dark circles like a bandit, sort of, kind of uneven, not very skillfully drawn. Someone tried to make them a whole lot smaller, and there's stripes radiating out from the edges of the bird. You wouldn't notice it unless you've worked with this sort of thing before, because all of it's so dark, you know, in such bad shape. But if you really scrutinize, you can see it's darker and heavier around the eyes, for lack of anything to call them. Yep. The more I look at it, I think it's an owl, and the yellow dots are a messy attempt to cover them up by turning them into owl eyes. Or something like owl eyes."
I was beginning to see the stripes, the feathers in the dark shading he was describing, and the way the bright yellow eyes were lined with dark ink, as if someone had wanted to make them smaller.
"Someone gets something with yellow dots, doesn't want it anymore, and has something else put on top of it," Pitt said. "Since the top layer of skin's gone, most of the new tattoo, the owl, came off. I guess the needles didn't go in as deep on that one. But they went in real deep with the yellow dots, a lot deeper than necessary, which tells me two different artists are involved."
He studied the block of skin some more.
"You can never really cover up an old tattoo," he resumed. "But if you know what you're doing, you can work over and around it so the eye is taken away from it. That's the trick. I guess you could almost call it an optical illusion."
"Is there any way we can figure out what the yellow eyes might originally have been part of?" I asked him. Pitt looked disappointed and sighed.